The following recording is offered by the Village Zendo. For more information, please visit villagezendo.org.
So those of you on this side of the room can watch it either way. It's kind of interesting. The technology is constantly evolving, isn't it? So is the Dharma, in a way. Our ways of bringing it in, allowing ourselves to find the teachings in everything that we encounter. So it's good to see everyone here today. Nice, just the right amount of folks here. I think how fortunate we are to have this place to come on a Sunday morning. We organize ourselves, we come in, we sit quietly, we have these forms that help us so things are not too confusing, and we practice this inconceivable form of just sitting. We set up this whole structure and maintain it in order to do this very simple thing. Isn't it funny? We need forms to help us do that. You know, Dogen said in the Fukan Zazengi, it's just letting body and mind drop away. It's just for a few moments, to let all the constructions, all the things that we put together and devise, just drop it. See what's really there. It's marvelous. So I just am filled with appreciation that you came today. And those of you who come and open it up and get things going, I really appreciate it that you do that. For everyone, and for me, personally. Scramble mind. She comes here and is able to sit. But, you know, there's this kind of whole idea we have of our body and mind. If it drops away, what's left? What would be there? In Zen, we'll say, just this. So just let. Not even let it, but let. Without forcing ourselves into a description. And instead, just sit. But of course, it is description in some form that has drawn us to this practice. Somewhere, sometime, we heard or read about the power of meditation. Maybe the power of Zazen. Or maybe of Zen. Or Buddhism. Or spirituality. Whatever we read or heard somehow encouraged us to practice. We were drawn here by our ideas of what we might attain, what we might learn and take home with us. And then imagine our surprise when we discover that the language of Zen is always telling us that what we're searching for is empty, is no thing. The thing we're searching for is no thing. And then we have our koan study where we constantly being asked to point to emptiness. You know, in our chanting this morning, the emptiness of all the five conditions thus completely removing misfortune and pain. And we chant further, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. And in fact, that all dharmas, all teachings are emptiness. So what happens to these benefits of Zen practice if they're empty? Besides, what is emptiness? How could it serve us? How does it serve the world we live in? Zen Master Baoqi, who was a 17th century Chinese woman Zen master, is one of the poets that we're reading in our Ango text this 3 month, this 90-day Ango period, called Zen Echoes, which has the verses of three Chinese women Zen masters who write comments on koans in verse. So Zen Master Baoqi, who was by far my favorite of the team, wrote about emptiness. From the void she plucks a flower. In the water she floats the moon. The crime has filled the universe. How can one explain it in words? From the void she plucks a flower. In the water she floats the moon. The crime has filled the universe. How can one explain it in words? How can you pluck a flower out of emptiness, the void? An ordinary object, a flower, probably a lotus we would imagine in our mind, somehow pulled out of the vast emptiness that is the universe. Is that hard to take in, that notion? Is it that this flower is like each of us when we only see one side of ourselves? The physical body, the thinking mind? Is it like in the water she floats the moon? Think the Hudson, huh? Or the East River. We see a moon floating, but we can't grasp it. We know it's a reflection. We can see the moon. Moon is, you know, usually a symbol of truth, or clarity, as it floats in the sea of life. Your life. And then she says, the crime has filled the universe. Uh-oh. What is this crime? Trying to distinguish, separate our individual self and the great emptiness? Isn't it trying to, or tending to, not recognize that there is no separation? That the separation is in our mind. She says, well, how can one explain it in words? This is her last line. Because it's not possible. And yet our very beings demand the words, the description, don't they? I mean, otherwise, be lost in this indescribable void of emptiness. It's a conundrum. Why do we even have language if not to discriminate, to see what's of value, what serves us, what serves others, and what doesn't? It is one thing that separates us from other creations, in our ability to name. That is an iPhone. To give information about a thing. So how does emptiness serve us? Why would we ever want to engage a practice that defeats our ability to name and analyze? Why would we do that? So I would say that so much of the Zen canon is an effort to explain this problem. One of my favorites is a simple one by Khetsu's cart, case 8 of the Mumonkan. It also appears in the Blue Cliff record, but I forget which case. Master Geton says, Khetsu made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. Take both the front and rear parts away and remove the axle. Then what would it be? Khetsu made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. Take the front and rear parts away and remove the axle. Then what do you have? So that could be like in your imagination, any kind of cart. It could be a very fancy one, like from the Lotus Sutra, one of the carts that the father gives. Or it could be just a plain and functional cart. I always think of my first wagon that I had, a little red wagon when I was a kid. But it's a cart. But then if you take off the wheels and the front part, and the back part, and what's underneath, where's the cart? All the parts are lying around, but where's the cart? Was the cart ever really there? So, this funny distinction between our tendency to name something, a moment, a process, a feeling, a person, and fixate on it, and then separate it from everything around it, is everywhere in our thinking. This is how we distinguish things. It has good aspects and bad excess. The idea of race, where did that come from? How about only two genders? That's a rule that we've constructed. How about my country? My ethnicity, not yours. So this idea, this Buddhist notion about cart, language, discrimination, is such an old, the cart as an image for that is such an old way of thinking about it. That there's a verse from the very earliest Buddhist nuns, Vajira, which is from the earliest scriptures. She's sitting zazen, and the devil, Mara, comes to tempt her away from her zazen. He begins to ask, you know, is he? Who knows? Mara might be this wild woman. Mara starts to ask her theoretical questions about herself. By whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of this being? Where has this being arisen? Where does this being cease? To be or not to be? The questions, you know, posit an isolated person, a separate, non-contingent being, right? Who is the maker? Why is this being arisen? Where does this being cease? But Vajira responds to Mara in her meditation practice. She wants to get away so she can practice. Why do you assume a being? Mara, have you grasped a view? This is a heap of sheer constructions. Here, no being is found. Just as with an assemblage of parts, the word chariot is used, so when aggregates are present, that's the convention of a being. So in that second part, the first part she tells us it's a sheer constructions of our mind that create this. Take these parts and make it into a cart, a chariot. Just as with an assemblage of parts, the word chariot is used, so when the aggregates, eye, ear, nose, throat, tongue, body, mind, are present, there is the convention of, inkyo. So, when we drop our notion of this self as separate entity, as a cart or a chariot, when we are able to drop that, we free ourselves enormously. We free ourselves to experience time and space in a very different way. This is what's happening on our cushion. Because we're always changing, you know, and dropping parts, flowing into and away from aspects of self and other. It is the magnificent flow of life, shifting like the shadows in the sun. So the verse and the koan itself are both pointing to something really important. Who are we? How can we encounter ourselves as parts of something larger, whole, and yet moment to moment changing as everything around us is changing? What would that look like? If the cart is a bunch of parts sitting on the ground, what happened to the cart? Where is the cart? If we let go and let go and let go as we practice, where are we? What would it be like, even for a few moments, to drop that fixed sense of self? Can we transcend the shape of the cart? Of my cart? Yourself? Can we throw out me, 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 and move more freely in the world? This is what happens when we encounter vast emptiness, the absolute, utter, wholeness. And that's when we can realize and recognize our interdependence, our utter connection with everything, to all that is. All that we can't even quite conceive of. The vast reaches of the sky, of space, the ocean of mind. When we practice and are able to enter into this quality of mind that is empty, that we call emptiness, everything that we do and everything we conceive of is wrapped around a concept that Thich Nhat Hanh called interbeing, which I love that phrase, interbeing. This kind of quality of mind that we can have for a few moments where there is no separation, no comparison, no doubt, none of that neurotic tentativeness that paralyzes us. We act in the world because we are part of the world. We are not separate. We are not a cart with a fixed self. But we are always changing, always responding to each moment of reality. We are, as Zen likes to say, just this. So I introduced all of these Zen concepts in order to speak a little bit about two individuals that I want to celebrate. Here we are in mid-January. Two individuals who are not Zen people at all, but deeply spiritual, deeply mystical religious leaders who have made such a difference to all of us in this world today. You may know that tomorrow we celebrate the Reverend Martin Luther King's birthday. His birthday was on the 15th, but we celebrate it on the third Monday or whatever it is. And a week ago on Saturday, on the 11th, was the birthday of Abraham Heschel, the Jewish theologian. Heschel, you know, he survived the Holocaust. And he came to this country and served as a rabbi and professor of Jewish studies right here in New York City at the Jewish Theological Seminary. You know, and he was deeply learned in the Jewish theological tradition, scholarly tradition. And he was quite the mystic. I encourage you to read some of his book. I think the book on the Sabbath is the best one to start with. It's just quite marvelous. And at the same time that he was this great scholar and mystic, really, he recognized, realized, and taught everyone that social activism is a requirement of spirituality. And this is what distinguished him in 20th century America. He wrote, you know, I mean, he was deeply, deeply religious man. We do not step out of the world when we pray. We merely see the world in a different setting. The self is not the hub, but the spoke of the revolving wheel. It is precisely the function of prayer to shift the center of living from self-consciousness to self-surrender. Isn't that marvelous? The self is not the hub, but the spoke of the revolving wheel. He worked. He marched against the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement. You may have seen photographs of him with Dr. King. He wrote, "There is immense silent agony in the world, and the task of man," well, this is like, you know, mid-century. We wouldn't say that anymore. "The task of all peoples is to be a voice for the plundered poor, to prevent the desecration of the soul and the violation of our dream of honesty." He continued, "The more deeply immersed I became in the thinking of the prophets, the more powerfully it became clear to me what the lives of the prophets sought to convey. That morally speaking, there is no limit to the concern one must feel to the suffering of human beings. That indifference to evil is worse than evil itself. That in a free society, some are guilty, but all are responsible." Consider now what we're all facing with global warming. All are responsible. But Heschel, you know, is a mystic, Jewish mystic. He penetrated this mystery of what we call emptiness. And he found himself marching with Dr. King and demonstrating against the unjust war that was going on during his time. And then tomorrow we celebrate Dr. King, who came to symbolize the fusion of that deep spirituality with really skillful social action. We are still following the patterns that Dr. King laid out. You know, this responsibility was kind of thrust on him. He was a youngish man. He could have just done well in his community, and he didn't have to step up, but no one else was stepping up. In his last sermon, Christmas sermon, he offered a great teaching that I want to read to you. It's a little long, but we have time. He said, "It really boils down to this, that all life is interrelated. We are all caught in the inescapable network of mutuality, tied into a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." I mean, you know, just that much, considering where we are today. He goes on, "We are made to live together because of the interrelated structure of reality. Did you ever stop to think that you can't leave for your job in the morning without being dependent on most of the world? You get up in the morning and go to the bathroom and reach over for the sponge, and that's handed to you by a Pacific Islander. Do you want me to stop now or later?" Just teasing. I like this, though. This is very specific. "You get up in the morning and go to the bathroom and reach over for the sponge, and that's handed to you by a Pacific Islander. You reach for a bar of soap, and that's given to you at the hands of a Frenchman. And then you go into the kitchen to drink your coffee for the morning, and that's poured into your cup by a South American. And maybe you want tea. That's poured into your cup by a Chinese. Or maybe you're desirous of having cocoa for breakfast, and that's poured into your cup by a West African. And then you reach over for your toast, and that's given to you by the hands of an English-speaking farmer, not to mention the baker. And before you finish eating breakfast in the morning, you've depended on more than half of the world. This is the way our universe is structured. This is our interrelated quality. We aren't going to have peace on Earth until we recognize this basic fact of the interrelated structure of all reality." And, you know, it's very specific, describing what we call the vast emptiness of any one view, self and other. the specificity teaches us, you know, these parts of the cart. He was such a gift to us all. Maybe I've been a little sloppy portraying these such broad strokes with these two great beings who have made such a difference in the world of activism in our country. But I believe both of them were touched by this quality of emptiness that we talk about in Zen as if it's our special thing. Just like Keichu talked about the cart, or the nun Bauchi, or the nun Vajira in India, northern India, many years, about 300 before the Christian era. They were all pointing to the same quality of wisdom, something that we do when we enter here, although we may not realize it. We're touching in to that emptiness. We may not notice it. It's right here. So let me end with a gatha. Empty sounds so empty, but it's really full. Full of life and suffering and joy and tears. And when we let go, when we take apart the cart, everything can be fresh and new.